Hello,
and welcome to episode number 70 of the Point of Convergence podcast. As always, I am your host, Exoacademian. For those who've spent decades searching for answers to the elusive yet seemingly ever-present enigma, colloquially known as the UFO phenomenon, the last several years have been a whirlwind of activity and revelations. It is well understood by those veteran to this field that elements within the U.S. government spent decades not only covering up details that made it abundantly clear that there really was a there, that we were being visited by non-human intelligences operating craft of the most sophisticated nature, but they simultaneously sought to silence those who sought to proclaim this very fact to the masses. Using a combination of scorn and ridicule at minimum, and personal and professional attacks and even violence when necessary at maximum, the U.S. government's general approach to the matter of the UFO phenomenon was to squelch public interest in this topic while simultaneously doing its darndest to understand it. Of course, part of the reason why that approach remained static for so long is that the secret keepers didn't make much headway in terms of really getting to the bottom of the enigma. Yes, there have been crashes and crash retrievals along the way, including of craft that evidence now seemingly suggests we did manage to bring down on occasion, and there apparently have been some major technological breakthroughs as a result. But the real root of this issue still remains elusive, and here I speak of the identity of the beings who are parading around our skies with impunity and who are interacting with and sometimes taking aboard their craft and into what appear to be other apparent domains of existence, civilians who the military is powerless to protect, even if it wanted to. This is not to say that these so-called abductions are purely malevolent in intent, but merely to point out that, when you get down to it, part of the reason the government has kept this under wraps for so long is that they have zero ability to police the skies within our nation-state borders, and thus they are failing in one of the core tenets of what makes a nation-state viable to begin with. In other words, why should a populace ascribe authority to a government structure when it is simply unable to ensure the smooth running of a society with even the most basic guarantee as to citizen safety? Not only is the notion of so-called protected airspace rendered meaningless by these others as they buzz in and around our skies, but so too are physical boundaries like locks, doors, walls, and the like. When they want, these others can appear in your room in the middle of the night, and there's nothing the government or anyone else can do to prevent it. And here I really do mean literally nothing. And this is because these others have demonstrated the ability to control consciousness itself. Thus, even if you stationed an entire military brigade outside a known abductee's house, these alien beings would make child's play of getting around these safeguards, including by putting the entire troop into a deep sleep or simply putting them into a temporary state of suspended animation until they are done with their business. As I mentioned at the outset, the government's about-face in recent years really has taken long-term ufologists by surprise. These veteran researchers spend so many decades trying to get the government to open up about what it knows about UFOs and the beings operating them, that many of them have been shocked by how quickly things have been changing as of late. For the first time in history, we really do seem to be on the verge of full-blown disclosure. And by that I mean not only the acknowledgement that some of the craft and phenomena being spotted regularly in our skies are not the property of the U.S. military or any other known nation-state operator, but also that we are being visited by non-human entities of a sophisticated nature who seem to rank higher on the proverbial food chain than do we human beings. Heady days indeed. And again, everything I'm hearing from my sources suggests this really is happening. We really are on the cusp of a civilization-changing series of disclosures. Announcements that will unquestionably and irreversibly change the way we human beings think about ourselves within the larger context of an immense, ancient, and multidimensional cosmos. But we again come to the real question at hand. Who are these others? Where are they coming from? How long have they been here? What are their intentions? How many of them are there? Are they one group or many? These are the fascinating yet daunting matters we'll seek to engage with from the vantage point of a towering 30,000-foot view, overlooking the multidimensional landscape, if you will, in this, the 70th episode of the Point of Convergence podcast. As we embark on this new episode, let me begin by saying, welcome back. I've been gone over the summer, at least from this podcast, although I've been very busy with writing a book and doing field research, as it were. It's been an exciting summer, and I'm looking forward to reporting on some of that in the future, both in this episode and episodes to come. A couple of announcements I'd like to make before we proceed with today's topic. First of all, I'm excited to be one of the speakers at an event in New York City coming up on October 8th, titled An Inquiry into Anomalous Experiences and the Phenomenon, an intimate one-day conference in the heart of New York City. I'll be presenting at this conference along with several well-known others, and you can both attend the conference in person or take in the live stream. And from my understanding, the conference will be made available at a later time for people to listen to and watch YouTube videos of, and the entire thing will be shot professionally, so it should be a very engaging event discussing cutting-edge topics that we often discuss on this podcast, and I'm very much looking forward to taking part. I'd also like to take a moment to give a shout-out to my Patreon supporters, and to say that for those who are interested in becoming a patron of this podcast, I will be offering bonusodes for patron supporters starting this fall. That will be a once-a-month bonusode specifically for Patreon subscribers. And in addition, I will be doing Ask Me Anything sessions on occasion as well. That is specifically for Patreon subscribers. All right, enough of that preamble. Let's get on to today's topic. It is a big one, a 30,000-foot view discussion of the UFO phenomenon. Now, as I mentioned in the introduction, there are different notions about who these others are and where they're coming from and how they're getting here, even how long they've been here. And of course, another major question, perhaps the key overarching question is, are they one group? Is the UFO phenomenon a singular matter, or is it actually more like a pluriverse of different kinds of entities coming in perhaps through very different means and ways? First off, let's discuss extraterrestrials, as outlined in the extraterrestrial hypothesis. Now, some of you who've been on this podcast with me since the beginning will be quite familiar with this, but some people have entered the fray later on, so to speak, and so I want to take the time to outline each of these and also talk about how some of them overlap and some of the clear delineations aren't as clear as they might seem at first blush, even for those who've been studying this for quite some time. Now, when we speak of extraterrestrials, we should, of course, first note that it is largely an assumption amongst scientists now, cosmologists, astrophysicists, etc., that the cosmos is likely teeming with life. Even if the majority of planets, perhaps, cannot sustain life as we understand it, because there are so many galaxies, therefore so many solar systems with so many planets in each solar system, you should have enough Goldilocks-like planets like Earth that life should actually be prevalent throughout the cosmos, even if it is the exception to the rule. Because again, the cosmos is so immense, we should have plenty of life arising across that great expanse. Now, those who are skeptical to the notion that ETs could be visiting us, however, will point out that the universe is simply too large and the speed of light simply too slow to make interstellar and especially intergalactic travel even possible. What they're getting at here is that even if you could approach the speed of light with sophisticated spacecraft, the distances between galaxies are so immense that you would still never get here. Or even if you did get here, it would take many, many, many generations. In other words, it just does not seem very plausible to achieve interstellar travel in any kind of robust way and on a regular basis. And I should add, by the way, that we really are likely talking about interstellar and intergalactic travel. Because initially, earlier in the 20th century, before we understood much about the nature of the planets of our own solar system, many people assumed there likely was life in planets like Mars and Venus, our nearby neighbors. And in fact, part of the confusion is that some of the early apparent visitors to our planet that were extraterrestrial in nature, or at least claimed to be, said they were coming from such planets like Mars and Venus. Now this begs the question, why would they tell us this if it's not true? Is there any way it could be true that we just can't conceive of? It's difficult to imagine how they would be coming from there based on what we know of those planets, at least if they are the kind of life that we consider based on our current biological model. In other words, as time went on and we realized how lifeless and barren the planets of this solar system appear to be, we therefore assumed that if there is ET life out there, it is likely far beyond our solar system in other star systems within the Milky Way galaxy, and even beyond that in other galaxies altogether. And of course, there we're talking about extremely immense distances. Now, to those who would say skeptically that these distances make interstellar travel unlikely, if not impossible, I would merely counter with the notion that even in today's understanding of physics, we assume you could harness something like a wormhole in order to close space or fold space, as it were, and therefore really cut down on the time it would take to travel between star systems or even potentially between galaxies, even potentially between one part of the physical universe and another part, almost at the very other end. So according to modern physics, it is possible, and we've even done some work trying to imagine, at least theoretically, how you could harness and stabilize a wormhole to make such travel possible. However, there is an interesting wrinkle when it comes to the nature of space-time and how real it actually is, and we'll get to that later in this episode. But to be clear, extraterrestrials are certainly possible. We have been told by them, some of them, that they are indeed extraterrestrials. And even mainstream science thinks it's possible, even likely, that they exist. Although again, the question is, could they feasibly get here? Although again, just to point out what I just said one more time, via wormholes and the like, you certainly could. And that's even based on our current 21st century science. Lest we get bogged down in insane degrees of hubris, let's of course consider the fact that if a civilization exists that's thousands of years beyond us in terms of technological development, then likely they've found ways to close that distance in ways we have not even imagined yet. Next up, we have the notion of interdimensionals. Now here we're still dealing with physical universes, but with the notion that perhaps there are many or numerous timelines. Sometimes when people talk about interdimensionals, they're actually referring to beings coming to us from a different timeline, or even from a different point within the same timeline, as in time travelers from the past or the future. Either way, you still have space-time, but within that you have the notion of multiple universes and perhaps beings that can traverse the distance between these universes. Although once again, distance is kind of the wrong term to use, because these dimensions would basically be like narrow panes of glass sitting right next to each other. And once you knew how to do it, the distance wouldn't be the issue. It's about how do you traverse the membrane separating one physical universe from another. Now, here we should point out that it was theorists such as Jacques Vallée in the 1960s and 70s that first proposed the notion that perhaps these beings that were visiting us were actually interdimensional in nature rather than extraterrestrial because of the high strangeness associated with the way they would interact with us and the way they would interact and seemingly manipulate space-time. It is malleable to them, apparently. That's what Vallée noticed when he took in as a totality all of the experiencer reports. As Vallée has famously said, what the UFO phenomenon makes clear to us is that we do not understand space-time. But for instance, when you take into account how these craft, for instance, seem to just pop into existence in the sky, we don't see where they came from, they just pop in as if they're coming in from somewhere else, quote-unquote, and they exit in the same manner. This, amongst a myriad of high strangeness, led theorists such as Vallée and others to postulate that perhaps these were interdimensional beings. Now, of course, we should point out here that this notion arose because this was cutting-edge physics of the time. Physicists were trying to make sense of why our universe was seemingly so fine-tuned for us and for the development of life, which hinted towards a creator, an intelligent design, if you will. So what physicists came up with was the notion of multiple universes, and that perhaps every time you come to a decision point, one universe splits into two, and that happens again and again. So a universe is being born every millisecond, in fact, in a much smaller fraction of time than that. And that therefore, perhaps, if this is true, that these multiple universes exist right alongside each other, then Vallée and others postulated perhaps they're popping in from one of those universes and then popping back out when they're done. But here we should point out that at present, there is precisely zero evidence to suggest these other universes actually exist. Again, within physics, this was a notion that was postulated to explain why our universe appeared so well fine-tuned to life. So again, it's a theoretical postulation, not something that has been empirically observed. That's a key distinction to make. That said, even if multiple universes don't actually exist in the way that physics has postulated they might, that doesn't mean the notion of multiple dimensions isn't useful. In fact, I think it is largely essential that we think about these others and their origin sources as being like different dimensions. But here I think more about reality being a vibrational wavelength, and that you have multiple wavelengths coinciding, and these represent different dimensions. And when we think back to much of the experiencer reports, again, this notion of interpenetrating realities was front and center, even early in the 20th century, before many people were really thinking about these kinds of notions. So this is supported even by the experiencer testimony. These others that have interacted with human beings have said they've come from other realities that exist right alongside ours. And in fact, when they've raised concerns about, for instance, nuclear fallout around the time of the dawn of the atomic era, one of the things they told us is that we don't understand exactly how atomic weapons can interpenetrate realities that we don't even understand exist yet. And yet we were told by them this is exactly the case. And this is in addition, of course, to all the damage we're doing to the biosphere when we detonate these weapons of mass destruction. Now, here we should pause to point out that this clear delineation between the extraterrestrial hypothesis and the interdimensional hypothesis is not so easy to define. That in fact, even amongst the experiencer literature, we find lots of examples of beings that supposedly are both extraterrestrial and interdimensional, as we're conceiving of it here. Again, these are not easily separated. According to the literature, some entities and entity groups began as biological beings, but have since become post-biological, and therefore sometimes take on a kind of suit when densifying, you could say, into our 3D plus 1 world space. And by the way, this partly would explain why sometimes some grays, for instance, have a somewhat puppet-like nature to them. They look that way, not quite organic when people observe them. Now, there are some that I think are semi-organic AI, and that's what people are noticing and why they don't exactly look organic fully in their demeanor. But there may be these other kinds that are actually light beings of a kind, post-biological beings, who are actually densifying, taking on a suit, as it were. And this is not their true form, and that's why they look slightly puppet-like in their appearance. And I do understand that's complex and confusing. I think this is probably the most confusing, discombobulating matter when it comes to the UFO phenomenon, is that there are different groups, even different groups that look very alike. Now, speaking of the way these beings look, there is a vast assortment of types. You really would need an immense chart if you were to describe all the kinds that have been observed. Now, while allowing for shapeshifters, which certainly are likely part of the equation, we should not be surprised in a kind of situation we're describing here with an immense cosmos and perhaps even a multidimensional cosmos that we would have a vast assortment of types and shapes and species, etc. Now, in more recent years, it's the more alarming types that have gotten a lot of the attention. Here I speak of insectoid types like the mantis beings, and of course the quintessential gray aliens, as well as ones such as the reptilians, which look like a cross between a lizard and a human being, though often standing from up to 7 to 8 feet tall. But historically, especially earlier in the 20th century, more towards the dawn of the modern UFO phenomenon era, a lot of the sightings were of surprisingly human-looking beings. They either looked completely human, or they looked almost human, with slight differences, almost like a race that existed somewhere else on the planet that had never been discovered. Now, of course, many of these sightings were of human-like entities that looked taller than the Earth average human, and they had usually blonde hair and blue eyes. And to some, they looked so alike that they wondered if perhaps this was the fruit of some sort of eugenics program. But here we should make the point that, again, historically, many of the human-like entities, the alien humans, if you will, that were both spotted and interacted with over a long term, actually often looked very much like everyone else on the planet. In other words, they fit within the general spectrum of the kinds of human beings you would already find here. That could be people with average height, brunettes, redheads, different skin tones, etc. And of course, it goes without saying that this raises the possibility that these others, these specific human aliens, may have been living amongst us with us being none the wiser. And yes, in fact, that's much of what is reported amongst the experiencer literature pertaining to these specific kinds of entities, that they are here, they are observing, and to some degree, actually working to change the priorities of our civilization, which is viewed from an extraterrestrial point of view as very primitive and ongoingly flirting with self-destruction. And regarding that last point, I don't think any of us could disagree. And by the way, many of the reports earlier in the 20th century, in the early to mid-20th century, and a little bit beyond, were with a group known as the Space Brothers. These were the ones that looked very human, were supposedly coming from nearby planets, and were here on a peaceful mission to help us turn away from our self-destructive ways. Now, of course, one of the questions that arises is, if these kinds of sightings with these kinds of human aliens were so common in the 20th century, where did they go? Why are sightings and interactions with these others so rare when compared with, say, 75 years ago? Now, of course, we should begin by saying, if they don't want to make their presence known and they are here, we would have no way of really knowing who they were because they look and act just like us. They apparently have mastered our language and whatnot, and even though some of the historical cases involve them wearing strange clothing and perhaps having mannerisms that didn't quite fit, over time they could learn those kind of things to a sufficient degree that they would blend in seamlessly. That's one reason why we might not get so many accounts today. They may just be living amongst us without us being any the wiser. And in fact, I'm sure that is going on. But there's something else that comes into play too. Again, according to the experiencer literature, there were overtures made by this group to government groups to try and help provide technology and means to begin to transform the nature of our civilization, to make it less damaging to the planet and less divisive amongst different people groups. Now, as the narrative goes, and again, I think there's actually a fair amount of evidence for this, these overtures were declined by the governments of the time. Maybe perhaps because these governments didn't believe that their adversaries, for instance, the Soviet Union, would follow suit, and this would give, for instance, the United States a disadvantage comparatively, especially if part of the agreement was involving disarmament. This would have been in the midst of the Cold War, and perhaps the government at the time thought this was not wise. Again, many of us would question that decision, but nevertheless, that's apparently what happened. What we also hear is that after being declined by the governments of the land, opted for more of a grassroots approach where they interacted with certain key individuals on an individual basis, and that they are doing this across the planet in such a way as to produce a kind of bottom-up groundswell that could still, in the long term, transform the civilization. Okay, that accounts for the human-looking ones, the human aliens, if you will. What about the quintessential gray aliens? Are those all the baddies, as some people would like to suggest? I would say that's much too narrow a definition. I think the grays are quite common, and evidence would suggest there are multiple groups here. And in fact, that's indeed what some of the grays tell people, is that there are different groups, and that's part of the confusion, is that human beings see a certain type and then ascribe a certain group of behaviors to this group as a totality. We know among some of the racial problems we've had within our own species that this happens far too often, that stereotypes are assigned to certain people just because they look a certain way. I think some of that goes on here as well. We see a general gray alien, and then we lump them all together and sometimes even reduce the complexity of the behavior to make this short list of common themes that stand out. But I think often this doesn't do justice to the complexity of the experiencer reports and the nature of these beings. And in fact, it may be even more complex than this. It may be that these beings are coming from a different kind of reality, and when they translate into this reality, this is the form they take. This is the way they look to us anyway, almost like an icon. And again, we think of Donald Hoffman's work and how he talks about space-time itself is actually just an organization of icons that evolution has served up for us to see and interact with when really they don't reflect the underlying reality. In the same way, these grays might not actually look like this in their true nature, or they may not have a spatial-temporal sort of representation at all. But when they densify again, to use that word creatively, into this reality as we perceive it, they end up looking like this. This might also explain the complexity of behaviors and agendas we've heard reported that really cover the gamut. Now, as complex as is the extraterrestrial slash interdimensional conversation, there are additional types that have been described and postulated. One is that of an ultra-terrestrial, and Hal Puthoff recently published a paper that he wrote some years ago that outlines what these may be like and how we may be interacting with some of these. Now, what is an ultra-terrestrial? One definition is that of a superior non-human entity of natural or supernatural origin that is indigenous to planet Earth. Here I point out that they are kind of here and not here, or here plus somewhere else. They are often described as cross-domain entities. And this again partly explains some of the strange behavior we noticed, where they seem to be able to pop in and pop out of our reality, maybe because they exist here, but also somewhere else. Now, not only are UFO aliens lumped into this group, but so too are traditional types like fairies and elves. Many paranormal researchers believe these beings are ultra-terrestrials. Now, closely associated to this ultra-terrestrial type are ones known as crypto-terrestrials, as defined by the late researcher and writer Mac Tonies. Now, crypto-terrestrials lack some of the supernatural aspects that are sometimes ascribed to ultra-terrestrials, and they aren't necessarily cross-domain entities. In other words, they are beings, a sister humanoid species, fully indigenous to the Earth and only existing here, but perhaps having certain evolutionary capacities that allow them to hide their presence from us much of the time. Now, earlier we mentioned that beings that are coming across time or across timelines are also known sometimes as a kind of interdimensional. But let's give that a little bit more attention right now. According to Dr. Michael Masters, who is an evolutionary anthropologist who knows that of which he speaks, he believes the evidence suggests that the gray aliens we're so familiar with are actually what he calls extratempestrials, and very specifically, that they are us from the future. They are human beings who have further evolved to look now like a gray alien, who are coming back in time, according to him perhaps, because they now have an impoverished genetic pool, and they are coming to take some of our DNA to refresh their stock, as it were. And this would partly explain some of the strange genetic experiments and even the hybridization programs we are seeing. As a quick aside, by the way, while we're on this topic, I should point out that one of the narratives around one of the extraterrestrial groups that are here that are not purely benign in their intentions toward us, but are also not malevolent, is that they too are here to try to refresh their stock, that they are now diseased, and that they have certain compatibilities with human beings, specifically certain human beings, and therefore that certain bloodlines have been targeted for experimentation, hybridization programs, for the taking of fetuses and sperm and eggs and whatnot in order to address this malady in their own genetic stock. So we have this common narrative arising both amongst the extratempestrials and the extraterrestrials, at least some of them. And by the way, I think it's also important to point out right here that these are not truly malevolent intentions. They actually are trying to save their own species and are doing so perhaps through less than above board means by abducting, i.e. kidnapping human beings in order to take genetic material. But my point is just to say that they're not demonic or evil in that sense. And some people even report being healed by these beings and whatnot, and some even develop a kind of relationship. But it is a complex situation, and it is certainly not purely benevolent as we would imagine it. Although again, there are other groups, even other groups of Greys, who people do report having those kinds of relationships with. Again, it is a complex tapestry, and we do it a disservice when we try to reduce it, just for the sake of convenience. The complexity we've thus far outlined only gets more complex from here, because we also have to add in the group known as the Celestials, or by some as the Extradimensionals. Now here we should first of all distinguish between Celestials / Extradimensionals and Post-Biologicals. For instance, even the Zetas from apparently the Zeta Reticuli system, which are originally extraterrestrials, some of them reportedly are now post-biological, but this does not make them Celestials as this category is often considered. Celestials or extradimensionals are just that, beings that are outside space and time altogether and were never part of that construct. So they're not merely post-biological, they are trans-biological altogether. These are the Celestials or extradimensionals, and a good example of this would be the beings of light that Dorothy Izett famously encountered, which you can learn more about if you're interested in episodes 34 and 35, which was dedicated specifically to her encounters. Now, common notions of angels and demons also apply in this celestial / extradimensional category, although please note, here I'm referring to the beings themselves, not necessarily the dogma often attached to them. And speaking of that, of course, we would do well to remember that here the notion of angels and demons is predated by the notion of daemons, lest we believe it is somehow unfair or inconsistent to acknowledge such entities exist while not necessarily adopting certain religious perspectives about them from any one particular religious tradition. Now, thus far, I pointed out how complex it is to make sense of not only different entities and different entity groups, but even different origin sources for different entity groups. But I think it gets even more complex and interesting from there, because just as important as the question of who these others are and where they're coming from, their origins, i.e., is the question of who we truly are and what our origins truly are. And to this point, I would point out a couple key elements. Number one, the fact that humanoid and human beings are so often encountered as part of the experiential literature suggests that, contrary to what mainstream science would have us believe, we did not arise on this planet merely through the process of evolution originating from single-cell microbial life, as the standard story goes, but that perhaps we are the result of a vast cosmic seeding program that happened in the distant past. And suggestions are that we may have been tinkered with, enhanced, if you will, numerous times since then, including around 70,000 years ago, when there seems to have been distinct cognitive boost given to us. Gary Nolan is currently conducting fascinating and groundbreaking research to see if we can define certain biological markers that show signs of a kind of physiology unique to experiencers. If so, these signs may point to the latest in evolutionary trends. There is also mounting evidence that neurodivergent people are also more prone, or gifted, you might say, in perceiving and interacting with these expanded elements of reality. And of course, here when I talk about evolution, we also mean a kind of engineered evolution. By the way, a common claim of those who reject the notion that aliens would follow a moral trajectory similar to our own is that they share none of our genetic history. But of course, if a humanoid/human seeding program took place in the distant past, that would make some of them our cousins, which would mean that moral equivalence would not be so outrageous. Even amongst groups that look quite different from us, such as the Greys, although if you pay close attention, even there there are remarkable similarities, bipedalism, humanoid form, etc., a common theme amongst experiencer literature is that beings can incarnate into one of numerous forms, including the stereotypical human, Homo sapiens sapien form, and the Grey form, which again suggests a consciousness that overlays both of these different kinds of groups, which would suggest a similar trajectory in terms of moral development. Secondly, this ability to communicate via telepathy, mind-to-mind communication, and even for astounding feats such as telekinesis, impacting physical reality in measurable ways through mental intention alone, is something innate to all sentient beings. Some are just further along than others in these capacities. Again, this is telling us something about the nature of ultimate reality itself, I would suggest. And I would suggest that consciousness is therefore the bedrock that underlies physical reality, and this is precisely why matter bends to the will of conscious agents once this capacity has been realized. Now, speaking of this notion that space-time may actually be a derivative of something more primary, like consciousness, here we should note that the notion that space-time is doomed is not my wishful thinking, just as a way to imagine a scenario where the phenomena we're seeing with the UFO phenomenon, paranormality, and psi phenomena could be real, but rather that cutting-edge physicists such as Ed Witten and Nima Arkani-Hamed are telling us this is the case. They're saying space-time is doomed. And their conclusions have nothing to do with UFOs, aliens, and paranormality. They're seeing this as being evidenced based on what physics itself is telling them. And to be clear, when they say space-time is doomed, what they mean is evidence is suggesting there is a deeper level of reality beyond space-time, out of which space-time emerges as a kind of projection. Now, we already made the point that even if space-time is fundamental, is real, that these different alien groups could still utilize structures such as wormholes to traverse the immense distances within the cosmos. And in fact, according to Eric Davis's and Jacques Vallée's paper titled Incommensurability, Orthodoxy, and the Physics of High Strangeness, a six-layer model for anomalous phenomena, which I discussed, by the way, in detail in episode 59, a wormhole could be a portal for any number of types of groups that we've discussed today, including extraterrestrials, interdimensionals, and time travelers. But beyond that, what I'm saying here in terms of the latest cutting-edge findings in physics, if space-time is not fundamental, then these others wouldn't even need wormholes. They could manipulate the projection that is space-time directly. And that pretty much opens up all possibilities and would explain a lot of what we're seeing with the UFO phenomenon, general paranormality, and psi phenomena, all of which seem to violate the common sense rules of the space-time construct itself. And now I'd like to leave you with a few concluding points. You may have noticed that drawing conclusions about the nature of the who and the how of the UFO phenomenon very much depends on the trustworthiness of our contemporary model of reality, which I have stated is, at the very least, woefully insufficient and perhaps even largely misleading. That said, I still think this is very much a worthwhile endeavor, and that by probing the outliers in our datasets, we end up stumbling across new ideas, not just about the nature of these others in our midst, but also regarding the ultimate nature of all that is. And this gives birth to new models that we end up adopting, until they too start producing outliers that hint at an even deeper level yet. Notice here that the analogy of an onion comes to mind. It's not so much that our models are wrong, as that they are incomplete, partial, and only true within certain constraints or parameters. To be clear, this may very well speak to the nature of reality itself, that it too is more like an organism, less mechanical than often imagined, and operating not under the constraints of laws, but rather of habits, habits that also evolve over time, as Rupert Sheldrake has suggested. And of course, we are part and parcel within that. We too are part of the very stuff we're trying to understand. And by studying it, probing it, exploring it, we are likely expanding it. In other words, we are not merely passive observers. This was one of the main revelations arising out of quantum experiments that happened 100 years ago now. While some grow frustrated by this lack of certainty and stasis, I tend to take a very different approach. My attitude is one of excitement, because what this guarantees is that the adventure never ends, and that by embarking on an exploration into what ultimately is, we may in fact be seeding the very expansion we are attempting to chart out. And in this sense, we are an extension of the conscious cosmos itself, which progresses in part by seeking to explore and understand itself. And on that note, we've come to the close of another edition of the Point of Convergence podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast, you can do so by going to patreon.com/exoacademian. But until next time, friends, from deep within the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina, this is Exoacademian signing out.